of ordination is that you have to be able to stand up and give a message. So whether you're going to be a congregational or leader or not, you have to be able to stand up and teach the word. So this is why I'm doing some of this. And Psalm 27 is a particularly dear psalm to my heart. I've incorporated the Jewish practice of reading through Psalm 27 during the month of Elul, which is the month preceding Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. You read it twice a day through the month of Elul and all the way through Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, through to Shemini Atzeret and Hoshana Rabbah. So when we came to Psalm 27, I said, Rabbi, do you mind if I... I said, babe, honey. I don't call him rabbi at home. That's weird. I said, do you mind if I preach on it? And he's like, sure. And so I made mention earlier that it's so interesting how God is weaving these threads of the Exodus story through our service, because this is one of the things we're going to be hitting on when we talk about Psalm 27 today. So you can go ahead and open your Bibles to Psalm 27. But I'm a very different type of teacher than Rabbi is. So my slides, I probably have a good, like, least twice as many slides as he usually does. And they're going to incorporate more than just verses. And so I just want to let you know, if you're a note taker, have no fear. You can always watch this back on the live stream, or you can listen to it back on our media page on shalombrevard.com/media, because we've got a lot to cover. And so I'm going to go through it at a little bit of a clip. But if you need it, it will be there for you to refer back to. Some people are like, oh my gosh, I missed it. And I'm like, don't worry. Don't worry. Or you can also take your camera and just like take a little picture of the slides. So we're going to cover a lot. So you can put your finger in Psalm 27. We're going to start out there. And I just want to give you a little bit of the background of Psalm 27. Like I mentioned, we're not moving it forward. I don't know why. This was supposed to work. Why is it not showing on the screen? Or we won't have slides. Okay, so let me go ahead and start telling you the background. The practice of reciting Psalm 27 for the month of Elul is a relatively new practice in Judaism. And I say relatively new. It was the first recorded mention of it is in 1745. And we're all like, that doesn't sound new. That sounds really old. By Rabbi Yaakov Emden in his Siddur Beit Yaakov. It's also mentioned by some of his contemporaries. So we can safely assume that by 1745, this was something that everybody in Ashkenazi Jewry was pretty much doing. So that's 1745, which, like I said, sounds really old to us here in America. But considering, oh, there we go. We should be able to not do that, though. Okay, anyway. Purim has been celebrated continuously by Jews worldwide since the 5th century BCE. That's a long, long time. You should be able to put the begin, click on the begin slide up at the, or begin slideshow, which should put it on the thing. And the first Pesach was as much as 1,000 years before that, in 1500 BCE. So when we talk about 1745 CE, that's pretty new. But for us and what we think about, it seems like an old established thing. So the first question that probably you're asking, and why I have always, what I have always asked is, why is Psalm 27 chosen to be read twice a day for so many days? And I want to give you a quote from the book Psalms of the Jewish Liturgy by Miriam Glazer. She said, this psalm is not about self-abasement. It is not a confession of sin or an admission of guilt. In fact, it is a most tender expression of trust and an expression of yearning. This seems really out of place as we prepare to enter a time when we confess our sins and seek forgiveness from God. That doesn't make sense that we would read a psalm that isn't. Like, there's other psalms that are like, create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit. Like, why are we not doing that one? Well, we're going to talk about that today. Still not working. Okay. This is actually the perfect psalm to prepare us for the fall holidays, the high holy days. And so let's start with Psalm 27, verse 1. And I want you to notice that in your Bible, it should say at the very beginning, of David, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? So this psalm is attributed to David, but scholars believe that he didn't really write it for some various reasons, such as the fact that there's textual things that think that maybe lead to a later dating of the psalm. And they believe that it was probably a scribe that later on said, oh, there's not an author listed. Let's just put David in. But since we're, oh, this is painful to see it this way, but oh well. All right. So it is what it is. So it's probably not David that wrote it. But that doesn't mean that it's not still impactful, okay? Whether David wrote it or not, it has great meaning and great purpose, and we're going to go into that. So let's talk about why. The simplest reason why is explained in Midrash Vayikra Rabbah, which was compiled in the 5th century CE, so 500, which predates 1745. In 500 CE, the rabbis said that this verse, Psalm 27:1, regarding the new year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, it's because when it says, Adonai is my light, that's Rosh Hashanah, and my salvation is Yom Kippur. Well, that doesn't really make sense to me, and probably most of you out there are going, how do they get that? So we're going to go into some detail about this. And the first thing we need to talk about is the fact that when we look at the text, there's different ways to interpret the text. And we refer to those different ways by an acronym called PARDES, okay? Different meanings. And the PARDES is an acronym that stands for Peshat, which is the plain meaning of the text. In other words, I read it, the Lord is my light and salvation. That means God will bring light to my life, he will save me. The simple, simple meaning. We can all do Peshat. Remez, which is an allegorical meaning. So a lot like when Yeshua talks in parables. The meaning is not the specific meaning, it's an allegorical meaning. Darash includes a metaphorical meaning, and also in Darash you find connections through words in the text. And Sod is a hidden meaning. So when we read verse 1, the Peshat, the simple reading, is that the author of that psalm is reminding us and himself of the fact that God is the one who is our light, he's our help, he's our refuge, and we have no fear of anything or anyone. He lights our path, and light is often used in the Bible as a metaphor for deliverance or divine guidance. So in contrast to this idea that God is our light, we have Proverbs 4:18 through 19, which says, but the path of the righteous is like the light of dawn, which shines brighter and brighter until full day. So see, we have that connection to Psalm 27, but then we move on to verse 19, which says, the way of the wicked is like deep darkness. They do not know over what they stumble. So the psalmist is saying that because he has God, he has nothing to fear and no one to be afraid of. But if we look back at Psalm 27:1, according to the Darash, the way of reading that compares similarities in the actual Hebrew text, we're going to see that the rabbis made a connection between Psalm 27 and the Exodus narrative. So this one, and I've grayed out the portion that we're not focusing on. So Psalm 27:1, the very first phrase, the Lord is my light. There is a connection to Exodus 14:12. Where it says, there was a cloud and the darkness over here, yet it gave light by night over there. This ties also back to the verse in Proverbs that we just read. So if you read back through that narrative, you're going to see that there was one cloud. So this is as Israel is crossing through the Red Sea. It was nighttime. And the cloud that was in front of them goes behind them. So it's between Israel and the Egyptians who are pursuing them. The cloud comes behind them, and the text in Exodus 14:20 says that it was darkness for the Egyptians and light for Israel. We can't fathom that. How does a cloud have one side dark and one side light? It's God. We can't fathom it. but that's what it is. So this is why the rabbis say, the Lord is my light, means God is the essence of light and gives light to us. In Micah 7:8, it says, when I sit in darkness, the Lord will be a light to me. So even when we are surrounded by the darkness of this world, not the physical darkness, but the spiritual darkness, his light will be there shining on us and surrounding us and lighting our way. This all ties back to Psalm 27:1. So let's move on. The second phrase, and my salvation. And the rabbis connected that to Exodus 14:13, where Moses says to Israel, stand still and see the salvation of Adonai. Hey, thank you. AV, they're miracle workers. All right. Then it's easier to see. Fabulous. Okay. Stand still and see the salvation of Adonai, which he will perform for you today. So once again, the salvation connects to Psalm 27:1, the salvation. The next phrase, whom shall I fear? Moses says to the people, don't be afraid. The Lord is the stronghold. And the word in Psalm 27:1 for stronghold is ma'oz. And in Exodus 15:2, the Lord is my stronghold. It's ozi. Ozi, the E on the end, means mine. So it's the same word, but it's just a variation of it, that how it changes in Hebrew, but basically the same word. So that's a connection there. So once again, we have another connection to the Exodus story. And then, of whom shall I be afraid? Terror and dread will fall on them, the Egyptians. And it goes on from there. So that's just looking at verse 1 and seeing all those connections back to the story of Exodus. When we read the first verse of Psalm 27, we see that behind that simple reading, you can read it and get a lot out of that verse, but behind that simple reading, there's all these deeper connections, and we can see that God, just as he redeemed Israel from Egypt, we can be reminded that when we're preparing for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, that God hears our cries like he heard the cries of Israel when they were in slavery in Egypt, and he will redeem us and deliver us just like he redeemed and delivered them. So this reminder of the Exodus story as we're preparing for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and saying, you know what? God's going to redeem me. God has already redeemed me and has already saved me. And I need to remember that. So we've only gone verse 1. Let's go. Verse 2. All right. When evildoers assail me to eat up my flesh, my adversaries and foes, it is they who stumble and fall. Once again, let's look at the simple meaning and then the more complex meaning. So obviously, when evildoers assail me, who used assail in a word this past week? Nobody. But what that means is when they're coming after me, right? We all know, we've had that. People coming after us. Somebody wants to impugn our character. Somebody has it out for us. So that's an easy one to understand. To eat up my flesh. Well, that's a little weird, right? To eat up my flesh. That actually doesn't mean to eat up my flesh. The translators have translated it literally, but this isn't actually a Hebrew idiom. In the Hebrew, it says, le'echol et besari, le'echol et besari, which le'echol means to eat, and besari is my flesh. So the literal translation is correct, but idiomatically, it means to slander or to curse, okay? So when evildoers are coming after me to slander me or to curse me, and we know that this phrase means that because we see it in Daniel 3:8, they translate it along the phrase of the idiom. So they say, therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. And when we look at it in the Aramaic, because Daniel was written in Aramaic, the Aramaic phrase that is maliciously accused is ve'achalo kartzehon. And ve'achalo, that's a variation of to eat. And kartzehon, it's interesting. It's to eat morsels of or to chew up. So, I mean, when somebody slanders you, aren't they basically like chewing up your character, right? So this idiom is here, and it's translated as slander or malicious accusations, and it's also found in Daniel 6:25. So these people are attempting to slander and to accuse the writer of the psalm. Now, when I say they're accusing, I'm sure some of you have thought of other verses in the Bible. Where else do we see that there is an accuser? The first one is all the way back in Job 1:6. Now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan, as we know it, or Hasatan in the Hebrew, which can be translated as the adversary or the accuser, also came among them. And why is he called the accuser? Well, in our English translation, it's Satan. The Hebrew is the accuser or adversary. And it's because he is there to accuse Job of only being faithful to God because Job's life was one of prosperity and wealth. And so he says, God, if Job didn't have all this good stuff, he would turn away from you. And God's like, we'll see. And then the rest of the book of Job. But then, this isn't the only place when we see that. We see it in Zechariah 3:1. Then he showed me Joshua the high priest. This is what Zechariah says, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan, Hasatan, standing at his right hand to accuse him. So once again, and then our next one is in Greek, so it doesn't say Hasatan technically because it's Greek, but it's the same thing. Revelation 12:10, and I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah have come, for the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before God. So this is talking about Hasatan, the accuser, and this is talking about in the future when Messiah has come and Hasatan will have no ability to stand and accuse us anymore. But what this establishes is that the accuser accuses us day and night before God. That is relentless. Like, it's bad enough when we have somebody accuse us of something once. Imagine somebody standing day and night in front of you and saying, you're this, you're that, you're bad, you're horrible. And standing in front of God, and God's like, no. But this is what Hasatan does. He stands day and night before God to accuse us. The interesting thing is that in the Midrash for Psalm 27, too, the rabbis say that the phrase, eat up my flesh, means to accuse, and then they connect it to Hasatan as well. So in Hebrew, each number has a numerical value, because Hebrew did not have Arabic numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4. They use, like, Aleph is 1, Bet is 2. So each number has a numerical value. And so what the rabbis will do is they will take the numerical value of letters in a word and add it all up and say, look, this is this. So in this instance, they have took the numerical value. And the Midrash says that the numerical value of the word Hasatan is 364. And that every day of the year, Hasatan has authority to make accusations against us, except on Yom Kippur. Isn't that interesting? So he stands there day and night, but on Yom Kippur, he must be silent. So that's something that we need to remember. When we read Psalm 27:2, as we're going through during Elul, you know, and we're thinking about the things we need to ask forgiveness for, we need to remember that it's just us approaching God on that day. There's no accuser standing right next to us saying, yeah, see, they did that, they did that, they did that. No. He is silenced on that day. So as we go on, let's take a look at Psalm 27:3. Though an army encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. That's a whole lot of people coming against you, an army. Though war arise against me, yet in this I will be confident. Sometimes it feels like everyone is against us, or everything is happening against us. And the accuser himself is coming against us. But we have to remember the words of verse 1 and this verse in verse 3, that God is our stronghold. That whatever accusations or whatever opposition come at us, it's nothing. So in this season, when we're recounting all the things that, you know, we need to clear up between us and God, all of that other stuff is not there. It's very easy to feel like, the pylon from all the people and all the circumstances and all the things. But this is a reminder to us that it's just us and God. It's just us and God. The psalmist is not afraid of those who are trying to slander him or physically harm him. He goes on to say the next thing. This is a turn in the narrative. 27:4 says one thing. So he's already established that he's not afraid of anybody coming against him. He's not afraid of all these things because God is his stronghold. And then he says, one thing have I asked of the Lord that I will seek, that will I seek after. So he's going to pursue having this one thing, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. And the word for inquire means to like meditate, to seek, to pray. So it can encompass all these things like praying to God, inquiring through reading his word, all of this. And so the rabbis wrestled with this and they said, well, does this mean that we're supposed to abandon daily life and just only seek to be in God's presence and study every day? And they said, well, that's not practical. Because if you study every day, then you're not doing the command that says you're supposed to be kind to your neighbor and help the widow and help the poor. And so you can't just cloister yourself in a monastery. I mean, there are people that do that. But in Judaism, that's not something that is practiced and is ideal, because they say that that doesn't give you the opportunity to practice out what it is you're studying. So this is kind of, the psalmist is saying he wants to dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, but what the rabbis say is the meaning of that is really that we should be able to have that presence of the Lord in every aspect and in every day of our life, that we should be seeking after his presence in all ways, seeking to not see his literal face, because Exodus 33:20, Moses asked to see God, and God says, you cannot see my face, for man shall not see me and live. So we know that on this side of heaven, on this side of, in this world, we cannot actually see his literal face, but we can be in God's presence, and we need to seek after that. We can create these holy spaces. One of my classes, it was Messianic Jewish Spirituality, and Rabbi Schiffman was talking. We've had met Rabbi Schiffman before. He's great. He was talking about this, and he said, everybody eats. All the animals eat. People eat. We all eat, right? But what makes us as humans different than animals is that when we stop and say a blessing before we eat, we are acknowledging God, and we are making the act of eating holy, because we are honoring that he provided that, and that sustenance will keep us moving and going. And so just the act of saying that blessing creates a holy space. So when you say, how can I have, you know, be in the temple of God, I can't stop, I got to work, I got to do this, I got to do that. There's little ways throughout your day when you can create a holy space where you can be in God's presence. When you can take that time, driving to work, you can put on some worship music. Lord, just help me to feel your presence throughout the whole day. And listening to that. It does take time. It does take intentionality. And so this is perfectly poised within this psalm to remind us that we have to, as the psalmist says, pursue this. We have to seek it. This doesn't just accidentally happen. I don't feel God. Some people say, I don't feel God. Well, are you taking the time? Are you stopping? Are you saying the blessing? Or do you just sit down at the table and scarf down your food? So just that extra measure of a little bit of time reminds us that we need to pursue this closeness with God, especially as we're heading into the fall holidays. We'd want to focus not on the darkness or the people pursuing us, but we want to pursue the beauty of the Lord. The other thing I want to say about this is I did a whole other teaching for Sisterhood a few years ago called Creating a Sanctuary that really talks about this, creating sacred space in our time. You can go to neshamawomen.com, and under the Sanctuary tab, there's the video of that teaching if you want to watch that. So let's move on to the next verse, which gives us another connection to the fall holidays. Psalm 27:5. For he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will lift me high upon a rock. So once again, we're returning to this idea that we're sheltered, we're covered by God. And you'll see next to that word shelter is the Hebrew besukah, which means in the sukkah. Does everybody know sukkah? Yes. Some people are like, yeah. If you're new here and you don't know what a sukkah is, come back in October. We'll show you. Anyway, the sukkah is that temporary dwelling that we build for Sukkot. So once again, this is a connection between the fall holidays and this Psalm 27. And this sukkah we build to remind us of the Exodus, and when we wandered in the desert. So once again, we're connecting back to the Exodus narrative as well. This is all interconnected. And so the sukkah was where we resided as we were wandering through the wilderness, and God was providing for us. And this kind of same verse shows up in Psalm 31:20. In the cover of your presence, you hide them from the plots of men. You store them in your shelter, besukah, from the strife of tongues. Very flowery way of saying, once again, people are trying to slander me, and you're protecting me from that. So very similar, very similar. That God's sukkah is a place of protection for those who are being slandered and who are other people are seeking to destroy us, that God's sukkah will cover us. So there's a deeper meaning, this darash meaning of the Exodus, once again. The Israelites, wait, let me go back. I don't want you to see that yet. The Israelites dwelt in the sukkahs. And in their sukkahs, we have to remember also, not just that they were protected, but that God provided for them. They didn't have attacks from the enemy. There was abundant food and water, even though they complained about it. Their clothes never wore out. Now, I'm not saying that your clothes are never going to wear out and God's going to just serve up veal and caviar for you, but we have to remember that he will protect us. He will provide for us. And interestingly enough, come to Torah for today, because our portion, John 6, yeah, Torah for today is actually going to touch on this as well. So it's God is weaving this thread all the way through Torah for today too. And just like Israel was delivered from physical slavery, this was a foreshadowing of the deliverance from slavery to sin that we have through Yeshua's death as our Passover lamb who was sacrificed for us. So there is a spiritual sukkah, because of course what happens physically is a foreshadowing of what will happen spiritually. So the sukkah has a spiritual sukkah, a more important sukkah. And Isaiah speaks about this in his prophecy, Isaiah 4, verses 5 through 6. Then the Lord will create over the whole site of Mount Zion and over her assemblies a cloud by day and smoke and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory, there will be a canopy. There will be a booth, which is sukkah in the Hebrew, for shade by day from the heat, and for a refuge and a shelter from the storm and rain. So this sukkah is made of a cloud by day and smoke and fire by night. Once again, this sounds very much like that Exodus narrative where it was smoke and cloud, and that was the covering for Israel, and there was light for Israel. God loves repeating these patterns. This is a sukkah that is not of this earth, no bamboo mats, which is the bane of every, yeah, Rabbi's laughing, every sukkah has bamboo mats and they fall halfway through Sukkot. But it will be spiritual clouds and flaming fire. Imagine that, how amazing that will be and how wonderful that will be. So the last verse that we're going to talk about today is Psalm 27:6. And there's yet another connection to the fall holidays. And now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me, and I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody to the Lord. So the simple reading of this verse, we have the first section of the beginning that says, and now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me. So to us in America in 2025, this doesn't really make sense. What does that mean? Your head will be lifted up. Do you have a step stool? Are you getting a ladder that's going to make you taller? Did your head fall down? What happened? It's another biblical idiom. And when we see a verse that refers to someone's head being lifted up, we have a song that we sing, My Glory and the Lifter of My Head. That's from another psalm. What that means is that that person will be exalted or will have victory. Okay, so when the psalmist is saying, now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies, he will have victory over his enemies. And because of that, he will offer sacrifices in the tabernacle, which is translated in the ESV as tent. Remember, the tabernacle was where they offered the sacrifices, the priests, and they would do that daily. And here it says he will offer sacrifices with shouts of joy. That's how they translate it, shouts of joy. But the word that they actually use in the Hebrew, now my thing is not working. Can you just advance it for me to the next slide? There we go. The word that they translate as shouts of joy is teruah. Does that sound familiar to anybody? Yes? Yeah. Somebody is like, teruah. So that is the name of one of the different types of shofar blasts for Rosh Hashanah. We have tekiah, shavarim, and teruah. And teruah is the right, the nine short blasts. So in actuality, it's not saying shouts of joy, but Rashi explains this and says, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me just say to you that the reason, so this to me was like a conundrum. I'm like, why do they translate it as shouts of joy? Because it's a shofar blast. And maybe it's because most people who read the text won't know what teruah is. Like, imagine if they said, and I will offer in his tent sacrifices with teruah. Other people would be like, what is that? But what we see, it's actually, it was not uncommon to have shofar blast when they were offering sacrifices. So if we go to Numbers 10:10, it says, on the day of your gladness also, and at your appointed feasts, and at the beginnings of your months, you shall blow the trumpets over your burnt offerings, and over the sacrifices of your peace offerings. They shall be a reminder of you before your God. I am the Lord your God. So we have in Numbers 10 that God's saying, there are certain times when you will blow the shofar, you will make these sounds over the sacrifices. So when the psalmist is saying this in verse 6, this is something that he's familiar with. This is also an example of how we don't really always retain that original Hebrew. And so you read shouts of joy and you're thinking, oh, people must have been jumping around. Woo! Woo! No, they're blowing shofars. The only translation I could find, and I looked at all the English translations, I looked at all the like Hebrew Bible translations. The only one I could find was JPS 1917, that's Jewish Publication Society. And they translate the verse this way. And now shall my enemies be lifted up, now shall my head be lifted up, mine enemies round about me. And I will offer in his tabernacle sacrifices with trumpet sound. I was like, that's a great translation. Why did we abandon that one? This is another reason why I say, listen, when you're studying, if you want to do an in-depth study of something, go look at other translations. It might help to give you a little bit more understanding. And it's so easy to do that now with online things like blueletterbible.com, safaria.org. You can look at all these different other translations to get a more full idea of what the text means. So that's a short little rabbit trail, just to say that within these six verses, we have words that bring to mind the Exodus narrative, which is the original story of redemption and atonement, as well as the mention of the sukkah and teruah. And so we're going to close on a high note that these six verses remind us that God is our light, our strength, and our shelter. We have nothing to fear if we are in his care, just like Israel at the time of the Exodus went out to the unknown but had nothing to fear because God was protecting them and providing for them. And come back next week, and we're going to see how the narrative shifts It would be great if you pre-read next week too, from verse 7 on, how the tone of the psalm changes and what that means and how it continues to connect to the high holidays, to the fall holidays. Shabbat Shalom.